No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype us at BBSRADIOPR. And we're anxious to get started tonight. And my co-host, Maria Sanchez, has just texted me and said, let's call her. She's on her cell phone. She's traveling.
I'm here.
Okay, great, Maria. I'm glad you're there. We're going to have an interesting show. We have a lot to talk about today. Let me start by telling you that we have a new co-sponsor on our statehood bill, which is a little unusual in that Congress is in recess right now, the House of Representatives. But Tony Cardenas...
Representative Tony Cardenas,
and why do you know that name, Maria?
She's from California.
She's from California. God bless California. They have more co-sponsors on our legislation than any other state. He's a Democrat from California's 29th district. So, Representative Cardenas, thank you so much for your support. Things are chumming right along. We've got now 194 co-sponsors. 166 in the House, 28 in the Senate. We're going to get on those senators and get some more. And so things are going our way. How are you, Maria?
You know, Michael, as we promoted, I have been in the San Francisco for the 126th annual conference of the American Psychological Association, which shows you how old the group is. To think about that, and I have met, if you let me go a little bit of whom I met at the conference,
please.
Anybody who is in psychology, and if you're not, I'll explain, but one of them is Aaron Beck. He's considered the father of cognitive therapy. He founded the Beck Institute for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy, which is also known as CBT. It's empirically proven to work. He was addressing us on his 97th birthday on Thursday.
Wow.
Then Irvin Yalom, who is out of Stanford, he's 87 years old. He's considered the father of group therapy, which is what the 12-step movement is centered on and based about, and also bereavement and cancer and all of those support groups. He is the one that really made it what it is today. And so I got to see him speak in person, and there was this long line of people who wanted, you know, to take their picture or get an autograph. He's not only, when I took group therapy at the master's level, did he write the textbooks, but he's also a prolific writer, and I read a couple of his books about his practice or about his clients and stuff. They're incredibly easy to read and riveting. So I thought, well, I've seen him, I've seen history, you know, he's like our modern-day Freud, as is Dr. Beck, the first one I mentioned. So I went about my business, and then I was walking across the lobby. This is all happening at the Moscone Convention Center in San Francisco, and lo and behold, there's Dr. Yalom with one man walking across the lobby, and I walked up and I said, sir, would you mind if I shook your hand? And he said, how about a hug first? And I was like, And so I give him a hug and I shake his hand and I said, you've changed my life. I wrote you twice. You emailed me back. I can't thank you enough for what you've done. And he would have lingered longer, and I thought, I've said my piece. So that was a huge highlight for me. And then Noam Chomsky, who's known as the father of modern linguistics, and he's one of the founders of cognitive science out of Harvard. He's 89 years old. I mean, this is what like I said, these are the rock stars in the field of psychology that have changed psychology as we know it today in our modern history from what Freud did. And they're there at this convention. I mean, in the conference. It was just unbelievable. So I got my psychology geek thing satisfied.
Well, that's great. And I hope you'll get me an invitation next year, because I would feel like a young guy with this group.
Yes,
89, 92, 87. It's amazing. Maybe I should have studied psychology. Makes you live longer.
Honestly, yeah. There's something to it. I was wondering about that, about the longevity of these fellows. And one of the reasons that I was happy to get into the field is, unlike most industries, which has ageism and sexism involved in them, even if it's not overt, psychology appreciates wisdom. So when I walk in the room, people see me and they think I've been at it for a while because of my age, and I'm automatically given this respect, and I don't feel that I'm prejudiced against because of who I am and where I am in my life. So, and then it didn't hurt that I got some grades yesterday. I got an A+ in one of my classes. I've never gotten an A+,
yay,
I don't think, in my life. And that was from
the
School of Clinical Psychology and Developmental. And then I got an A- in Cognitive and Behavioral Psychology. And these are both professors that are also well-regarded and esteemed and published and leaders in the field. And I was so honored just to take the classes from them, let alone do as well as I did. So it was like, this has been just quite the week.
Well, I mean, it's obvious that being on Shadow Politics has made you even smarter now that you're getting straight A's, right? No, that's amazing. And you know what? And just so our listening audience knows, Maria Sanchez is amazing. It's amazing that you're doing this at this stage in your life, that you're still pursuing knowledge and trying to make yourself better and trying to make a better contribution to the world. And I'm very proud of you, and we're proud to have
you
on the show. And it doesn't surprise me at all that you're getting A pluses.
Well, and you know what's interesting is because I got into psychology because I've been involved in philanthropy my entire life. My folks always gave and donated and volunteered my whole life, and I just took that as that's what you do. So literally, as a teenager, I've been volunteering. And I've even done it corporately and, you know, 501c3 and personally and privately and nationally and locally, you know, all on all levels, city government, et cetera, et cetera. So I got into psychology to become a therapist and, you know, to help heal wounds. And then now that I'm on the doctoral track, I realized my calling is more global. And there's a position that has started to be created in the C-suite, and it's called Chief Ethical Officer. And that's where I'm going to find myself to help make either foundations or corporations or governments more socially responsible and ethical, and I get to do that then on a larger scale instead of on the one-to-one that I was going to do as a marriage family therapist.
Well, I think that makes so much sense, just to add my two cents. Given your background, given the fact that you have dealt with people on a larger scale in so many different venues, from radio to other stuff that you've done, it seems that you really found, I would think that this is a perfect niche for you, is to do that. And I think you have so much to offer, Maria. Really, it's an honor to have you on our show, to have you be, you know, a partner in this whole enterprise, because you really are a remarkable person. And I hope that our listening audience understands, you know, that what an amazing person you are and sees you as a role model, because you're a great role model.
Well, and first of all, thank you. Especially coming from you, because you know the deep respect and admiration I have for who you are, what you do for the District of Columbia, what you've done with the family that you've raised, the amazing wife that you have, and all of those things. I mean, you walk the walk and you talk the talk. And so for us to have joined our energies together and the synergy that we create on the program, I just think, you know, we're not in this ivory tower and say, oh, do as I do, you know, or do as I say, not as I do, or like there are so many people who are phonies and...
yeah, unfortunately, not true.
Yeah. And all of that. So if we can inspire others to help make this world a better place, whether it's, you know, helping the homeless or the children or the foster system or the incarcerated, that was the other thing, is the keynote speaker is this man named Brian Stevenson. He founded something called the Equal Justice Initiative. He is an attorney out of Alabama, and he argues before the Supreme Court. He's got one case in 2 months. He gets people on death row out who have either been wrongly convicted, or the case that he's going to be arguing in 2 months is a man who has been on death row for 33 years, who is now cognitively disabled. He's incontinent. He doesn't remember his past. He doesn't remember the crime. So his argument is that that is cruel and unusual punishment because he doesn't have the mental capacity to understand why he's being killed.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, the justice system certainly needs a lot of reform, and thank God for people who are willing to stand up. And, you know, that's one thing. The death penalty is such a sticky issue, and it's so complicated. But one thing that you have to take into consideration is how many people have gotten off of death row on the basis of DNA evidence. So,
right.
You know, I think something we've learned over the last 20 years is that, you know, we don't have an infallible system. And we have certainly executed innocent people, which is horrible. You know, one thing that will always stand out in my mind is that on a visit to Arizona, I went up to Boot Hill, and there is a marker on Boot Hill that with a guy's name, and it says hanged by mistake. And I thought, wow, you know, what a horrible thing to say, hanged by mistake. But, well, while you've been out better educating yourself, preparing to make the world a better place, I went down to, I've been involved in the last 2 days in a couple of, events surrounding today's march. I think, as everybody understands, today is the 1 year anniversary of what happened in Charlottesville. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, not everybody knows that, because when people ask me today, what are you talking about on your program, and I mentioned that, they're like, huh? And I'm talking about wise, educated, politically aware people. So you might want to refresh everybody's memory.
Yeah, it was a year ago today that there was a march in Charlottesville, Virginia. It was organized by a guy named Jason Kessler and a bunch of alt-right and neo-Nazis who gathered to protest the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee. And in that melee that ensued from that march, a woman named Heather was killed when she was run over by a car and by somebody that plowed, somebody who described himself as a neo-Nazi, who plowed into the crowd and killed her. Her name was Heather Heyer, and and there were also other people injured. Some are still recovering from their injuries. So this was the 1 year anniversary. They had a march in a demonstration in Charlottesville, is my understanding, but they also had one here in Washington. And the one they had in Washington was in Lafayette Park, which is directly across the street from the White House. I've gone to a couple of events around this, a couple of anti-protests, I guess you'd call them. There were so many cops brought in. They brought in cops from Alexandria, Virginia, Arlington, Virginia, As you may know, if you know the District of Columbia, we have a tremendous police force here. We also have Capitol Hill Police and Secret Service and the FBI. I mean, we have a lot of law enforcement people in Washington, D.C., and I think they were all called out today. And as yet, I haven't heard of any, any altercations. The idea was really to keep the two parties apart, the protesters and the, well, let's call them the anti-protesters. So they kind of surrounded, I think they've surrounded Lafayette Park with police officers, so that the two sides can't come in contact with each other. And we hope that it's all peaceful. But I can tell you the two things that I went to have been very peaceful. One was a teach-in where I would say there were 600 or 700 people that showed up and heard from people from the Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center and the ACLU and members of Congress. And I actually spoke for a moment. And then another one was today on Freedom Plaza, where I would say there were several thousand people that showed up.
That was
one of four events. There were four events around the city that were organized with the idea that at the end they would all get together and march to the White House, to Lafayette Park. Now, I didn't get to Lafayette Park because I wanted to get back here so I could do the show, and they didn't start until after 4 o'clock. So that would have made it hard because you had to take public transportation and to get around. But yeah, several thousand. I was surprised there were so many people at our.
So Michael, you know how you've been attending some rallies that are resist for the party,
yes,
the Democratic Party. Was that the similar sentiment, or was it just to show solidarity and to memorialize what happened a year ago? What's your take on the emotion?
It's a great question, Maria, because the first one was certainly the latter. It was certainly a bunch of people coming together. It was on Friday. It was to learn what we could learn about this issue and have input into ways that we might be able to successfully, change things, to change attitudes. What can we do to help? Today was more of a mix of people who had that same sentiment, but also people, you know, socialists who are out there with bullhorns saying the only way to reform America is to tear the government apart because it's unjust. And, you know, they're much more of people with their own agendas. And I would say that the majority of people came to, you know, stand up and say, we won't allow this in our city, in our community. But then there were other people there certainly pushing their own agenda. And I don't think you can ever get away from that, you know, when you have a large crowd. People are going to take advantage of that.
And what was the agenda?
Well, in some cases, you know, it's what I would call a counter agenda. So you had people like Black Lives Matter, because they feel threatened by what's going on in Lafayette Square. And that makes sense. Right. But then you also had people that were there. I mean, I heard speeches about Palestinians and what was going on in the Middle East and socialists who have decided that democracy just doesn't work. And, you know, and we need to go to a socialist government, to all sorts of other agendas. But I think mostly those are just a handful of people. Oh, and the anti-Trump agenda. Certainly there were people that would have been the biggest. That would have been the biggest group other than those, I think, that came to stand up to the racists. There were a lot of people that were anti-Trump people, even though that wasn't really the nexus of what was going on. So there were people there pushing pushing different ideas. But in general, I think most people showed up, the rank and file, the people that showed up and came from all over the country. I talked to lots of people, people from Philadelphia and from nearby places like Annapolis and Alexandria, and from far off places like Chicago and Cleveland. I think most of them came to show solidarity and support against what was going on in Lafayette Park. One of the guys I talked to, for example, for a while, was a reverend from Virginia, from Fairfax, Virginia. And I asked everybody why they came. I mean, certainly, you know, it was obvious and to some extent, but I wanted to know their feeling about it. And the reverend came because he was in Charlottesville. He was in Charlottesville last year with several members of his congregation when that whole melee went down. And he said they were going back to Charlottesville this year for the one-year anniversary. But then when they heard that these guys were coming to Washington, D.C., they decided to come to Washington instead because this is their community. So, you know, there were people with different agendas, but I think most of them came to support the idea that, you know, we can't allow this hate speech to go unchallenged, especially in our community. And, you know, the one thing that I said on Friday when I got to speak for a moment at the teach-in was that we had to remember what Dr. King said, that darkness cannot drive out darkness, and that hate cannot drive out hate, that the only thing that can do that is light and love. And I think that I was encouraged to see so many people standing in the light today with messages of love. So many people. There were people that you know had terrible things to say. Not any nicer than the things that the people on the other side were saying. But there were many, many, many people that brought messages of inclusion and love. So I think that was really encouraging.
So as a reminder to everybody that it was because there was a statue of Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville, Virginia, at a park, and they were talking about taking it down. And so the white supremacists were advocating that not happen. But I have a picture in front of me that's dated Monday, August 6, 2018, and the statue is still there.
Yeah, it's still there. It is still there. And, you know, I think that if it had been an argument over the statue, really over the statue, that you wouldn't have had the kind of confrontation that you're having now. You know, certainly you and I, Marie, have talked about this on the air, about how we feel that this kind of, you know, removal of some of this stuff doesn't make sense, that it's assault on our history. But surely what happened in Charlottesville, the statue of Robert E. Lee was an excuse for these guys. It was an excuse for them to get together and protest, you know, and make something out of it. If they had just gotten there and had a regular disagreement in the community, you know, and I think that's really what's going on now, is we're having a national discussion. Because, you know, we have, I don't know what's going on in California, but certainly here, we're renaming a high school that was named after Jeb Stuart, and Jeb Stuart High School is a very old high school. You know, there are several other things. We've removed statues from college campuses, and, you know, so I think we're having a national discussion about race these days. You know, and it's kind of expanding to include things like sex and sexual orientation and equal rights for women. I think we're going through a cultural revolution in this country.
I would agree with you. And I believe, my personal opinion is, it's conversations that we should have had decades ago. And it's conversations that I still can't believe that we are having. You would think that we have evolved and grown and become more inclusive and all those things that were not. I've been having conversations with people here in the San Francisco area who remind me of, like, at Berlin, there are markers everywhere to remind you what went down, and so that the history of the wall will never be forgotten, and right. the Holocaust and all of those things. So I don't know if a statue of Robert E. Lee doesn't do that in a roundabout way.
I think, like I said, I think we've moved on from the argument about the statue. I think it's morphed into something else, but I don't know what you know, I have really mixed emotions about this. Sometimes I feel like these symbols on a college campus might be wrong, but I don't know why they're always wrong, why we have to rewrite history so we act like it didn't happen. You know, this is what the communists did, right? When they took over in China, for example, they got rid of all their history. I'll never forget my sister going to China very early on when Nixon first opened it up to Americans and Europeans coming over, and her telling me that she was there with really educated Chinese people that had no sense of their own history. It was like everything happened in 1949. Everything happened after the Communist Revolution. There was nothing before the Communist Revolution. I don't know that we want to do that. I think that we need to say, you know, the war between the states, or as Southerners put it, the war of Northern aggression was there were horrible aspects to it, and you know, the whole thing was horrible. We lost more people in that war than all the other wars combined. So this is not something, because I think like you believe, that those that don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. I think we need to learn. And you know, and one of the things I want to say about especially about women and women's rights is that as this conversation has unfolded, I've got to tell you that I'm flabbergasted by the things that I hear from women, even young women like my daughters, who act like things that I thought were very, were very unusual or didn't happen very often, they take for granted. You know, when I hear these things about sexual harassment and you know, how women haven't been able to be promoted properly, and you know, I hear so many women go, oh yeah. It's like it's been under the surface for a really long time, and now we're starting to have a real national conversation about it.
Well, in August, I just did my blog post for the rest of the month, and there's a National Women's Equality Day somewhere in here. And I phrase it, is it still necessary that we have such a day, you know, in this day and age, in the year 2018? And I went through the statistics, and yes, 76 cents on the dollar, and, you know, all the stuff that's still going on. In the workforce, and I mean, yes, it's a conversation we still need to have until there is equal compensation for equal, you know, effort.
And still no equal rights amendment. You know, lots of people are surprised by that we're still. Yeah. I think they just had another state ratified, so they're two states short, but it still hasn't been ratified. And another thing, you know, when we had.
Decades.
Yes, and when we had, I studied it, and I'm an old man, and I studied it in college. It was, you know, already in Congress. But and one thing that's really surprising is that we had a show with people on with our former host Kathleen. We had a show about the Equal Rights Amendment, and we had some young people on, and she asked them about Title IX, women. And they had no idea what she was talking about.
Yeah.
And that amazes me. That amazed both of us. We're like, how can you not? It's so important to women. How can you not know? But, you know.
And I said that on our program before. We women have done a disservice to the younger women to not share with them the history. I mean, Michael, even in my lifetime, I've mentioned that when I started playing basketball, there were six on a team. Four could only go half court. Two offense, two defense, and then there were these other things called rovers, and they could go full court because girls were deemed too delicate to play a full court basketball.
Well, we've come so far. I bet there are women out there today that could play in the NBA. I mean, it's the game has changed so much. I'm sure you know more about it than I do, but the game has changed so much because it's become such a power game under the hoop where size, you know, being 7 feet tall is a real advantage. But I bet there are plenty of women in playing professional basketball that could be point guards in the NBA because they're that good.
I agree.
And we've seen so many great women athletes emerge in such a short period of time, which just shows you the impact of Title IX, you know?
Correct. For people who don't know, it passed in 1973, I believe, that women were allowed equal access to sports on the collegiate level. And if they funded one for men, they had to fund one for women. Which is what Title IX was all about.
And let me tell you, I went to a big sports school. I went to the University of Maryland. And they found lots of loopholes in that law. You know what I mean? I mean, like, I'll never forget while I was on campus, even after that passed, we had several swimming pools on campus where the University of Maryland is a very large school. When I went there, there were more than 50,000 undergraduates. But the girls, the women's swim team, which was one of the top swim teams in the country, they got to practice in the old, tired out, worn out pool that was closed regularly because it was in disrepair. Whereas the football team got to practice in a brand new swimming pool that was built specifically for them to train, and nobody else was allowed to use it. You know, there were still lots of, I don't know how much of that has changed, but there was still lots of things going on like that. And, you know, the women, of course, the women from the swim team made an issue out of it. Like, why should we be relegated to the rotten pool when, you know, when this is our sport and we're really good at it?
Right.
You know?
Right.
So there's still that stuff that goes on, but
getting around. Well, you mentioned Black Lives Matter, and something, and I'm going to probably sound so ignorant, but it is what it is. I just learned this week in San Francisco about Juneteenth.
Yes.
And this woman started sharing with me she wants to help make it national, and I was like, she told me a little bit about it, and then I've since done some more research on it because I said I would help her to do whatever I could. But it's been around since 1865, and it's June 19th, and it's recognized as the African American Emancipation Day. And she said, rather than MLK Day, I would rather have this because this is global. And I thought, well, I don't think you have to choose. It might as well just keep the MLK Day in January, and then let's just add this. But I thought it's been around, and this was the first I heard of it.
Well, you know what? It's something that we celebrate here in Washington, D.C. It's relegated to kind of a second-class status because April 16th is Emancipation Day in the District of Columbia when the slaves were freed in the District of Columbia. We've talked about this on the show before, but it was the only compensated emancipation in American history when Republican President Abraham Lincoln bought all the slaves in the District of Columbia and set them free. But we celebrate Juneteenth here in Washington, D.C. Yes, and that she should look to the things we do in Washington, D.C., to if she wants to make it a national holiday. Because when I say we celebrate it, understand that we celebrate it locally. It's not a national celebration, but
right.
But locally, so, yes, we do celebrate Juneteenth.
Because it's got a June 19th, that means that it hits on every day of the week, as opposed to our three-day, you know, Monday holiday,
mm-hmm.
like MLK and President's Day and Memorial Day, Labor Day, those kinds of holidays. I wonder if there wouldn't be more traction to have it be on a Monday, like the third Monday in June or something like that.
Well, you know, I don't know about that, because these things are very sensitive. You know, every year when we celebrate Emancipation Day, we make a big deal about it because we don't have the same rights everybody else has. So we feel like we have yet to be emancipated. But there are people that are involved in the celebration that don't like that. They criticize us for it because they say it's a celebration of the end of slavery, and that's what it should remain. We shouldn't, you know, even though we consider ourselves enslaved still, we shouldn't use the holiday to promote our cause. We should use it solely to remember that it was the day we ended slavery. So those things are very, very touchy. So I would think you'd have a few problems with Juneteenth moving it to any other day, but yeah, it's a big celebration here in Washington.
How does it differ, the April experience, from the June experience in the District of Columbia?
Well, the April experience involves lots of people because we, you know, like I say, we use it as a platform to discuss our grievance about not being represented in Congress, whereas Juneteenth really is just a celebration for African Americans, and it's much smaller in that sense. That's the biggest thing. And it involves African Americans more than it involves people from other ethnic groups. Now, I've been involved in celebrations as an elected official, but for the most part, it's really more something that's confined to the African American community, and as you say, most people in America have never heard of it. So it's really you know, Washington D.C. has a lot of African Americans that have been involved in the civil rights movement right from the beginning. So we're more sensitive, I guess. I don't know if that's the right word, but we're more aware of the holiday than other jurisdictions. So I would
but
say
you know
that's
what?
The main.
Here's where my liberal tendencies come out: is I think that we as a country should celebrate it because it made us a better people to have African Americans emancipate.
Yeah, and I think, again, it's a matter of history. I think that, you know, when we talk about, to come full circle, when we talk about these alt-right people or these skinheads or these neo-Nazis that are out there preaching a gospel of hate, a lot of the people that they preach to, a lot of people that embrace it, don't understand the history. You know, they don't understand how we've come to the place that we've come to. And so I think that it would make sense to make it a national holiday.
Well, and think about it. If we evolve it nationally, think about how it can heal the soul and have catharsis. Because there is something that is empirically proven, and it's called transgenerational trauma. And that one of the reasons, and this is where my psychology is coming into play here, is that if we can heal as a country, we can then heal as a nation, and we can heal as a people. Because what the slaves experienced touched all of our lives. And by freeing them, that freed all of us. And it made the United States of America a better place. And therefore, we all benefit from that.
Right, and that's certainly the message that I think we need to deliver today, that, you know, the more inclusive we become, the more we stand up together as a nation, and we deal with healing the pain of the past, the better country we become. This isn't just about, you know, racism isn't just about hurting minority groups. It hurts all of us. It hurts all of us as a nation. We're a better nation if we're not a racist nation. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, just like I said about women, we're finding this out about race, too, that there's a lot of stuff that's been below the surface that is now coming out. And hopefully, if we can work through it, that we'll all be better people for it. And I think that was a big part of what the messages were today, that we're all in this together. And you know, that's why we all need to stand together for what's right.
Well, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free doesn't say anything about race or gender or sexual orientation or socioeconomic status or all the things that we stratify within the human condition. It says, give me your all.
Right. No, and that's the thing. And I think today, I've got to be honest, I think today some of the rhetoric against Donald Trump was because we the people on the left, at least, feel that we've taken the Statue of Liberty, which was our, you know, that beautiful Emma Lazarus poem, which was kind of our national pride, and now we want to put up a wall. You know, we've gone from give us your tired, you know, your poor, your tired, huddled masses yearning to be free to stay the hell out. We don't want you anymore. So I think that's part of the discussion that's coming, and we really have to decide.
Interestingly enough, my grandparents on my dad's side came through Ellis Island. It was always about legal immigration.
Yes,
so that's where I have a little bit of, but I don't think it's an apples and apples comparison. The wall.
Well, I would only say to that the wall, we all understand that the wall is nothing more than a symbol. You can't build a wall around the United States. You can't. No wall has ever worked. The Berlin Wall didn't work. The Great Wall of China didn't work. You know, it's about the symbolism. It's really not about the wall. And I hear all the time from friends of mine that live in border towns who are just exasperated by the terrible conditions that they have, given what's gone on recently. So I understand their pain. But I think they even understand a wall's not going to keep people out. It's a symbol. Right. It's just a big ass keep out sign for America. I think that's the way I see it, and I think a lot of liberals see it that way.
Well, interestingly, because I experienced it probably about 10 years ago. I only had one child at home at the time. My three sons were already adults. And so it was just my daughter and myself, and I wanted to go to Europe and to become an international correspondent back to the United States. In other words, have an American boot on the ground reporting what was going on in Europe back to the U.S. And I got a sponsor for it. A radio station said, sure, they would have me. You know, this is before we had more global news like we do now. Because I said, somebody, we're taking feed from, say, Europeans about what's going on in Europe, not necessarily with an American's point of view. And so got that all set up. My daughter was all excited. She was going to go to high school in Madrid and et cetera. And then they said, but you can only do it for 90 days. And I was like, why? And they said, because you got to go back home. Only if you're hired by a company that's based in the EU, that you perform a function that no one else can do, that we can't fill with a European, then you can come. And I was like, oh, okay, never mind. But that's how they protect their borders.
Yeah, no, I think most Americans believe in protecting borders. But again, I think that the objection to the wall is the symbolism of it, because I don't think you'd have the same kind of resistance to people saying that they wanted to expend more money on Border Patrol, or that they wanted to, you know, take other, you know, do other things that would increase border security. I think that most Americans would probably be in favor of that. I think the thing that they hate about the wall, or I hate about it anyway, let me not speak for America, is the whole symbolism of it. You know, one of the people that I know that supports the wall lives in a town where they built a tunnel that they spent millions of dollars on, and it was brilliant. They built it right next to the city water main. And every night they would flood it so that when they were looking for tunnels, they couldn't find it. They would mistake it as though, I mean, it was right next to the water main. And they would mistake it for the water main until some city worker one day said, hey, wait a minute. We don't have two water mains. We only have one. And they found out that they had this multi-million dollar tunnel that was paid for by private funds somehow.
And it was used, the drug cartel, don't you think?
Yes. Yeah, the drug cartel. And they use it to smuggle drugs and
right.
and you know, illegals into the country. And you know what? Some of those people in that town support a wall. You know, and I said to them, you know, how crazy is this? They're just gonna put up a wall, they'll dig a tunnel. And they say to me, but it'll slow things down. It'll mitigate a little bit. And I think what they really mean is it'll be a symbol that the border's no longer open. It's closed for business. Stay the hell out. And that's the thing that bothered me about it. And I got to tell you, I don't think that the rhetoric that has come out of the White House has helped this problem. I think that, you know, these guys come to Washington and feel they can protest with impunity because they feel that you know, this is acceptable behavior these days. And I think that bothers me.
So, Michael, forgive me for not also being aware that it's really philosophically the objection, not necessarily about the structure itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you just expressed that eloquently, and I can now understand that better. I get
it. Well, you know, that's my feeling.
Symbol.
And I think a lot of I'm not trying to say that that's the consensus of opinion, but I certainly, you know, I certainly feel that. You know, my grandparents as well came through Ellis Island. I consider myself the perfect American because my father's family was here during the Revolutionary War, and actually one of them was a Revolutionary War he was a captain in the Continental Army, whereas my mother was the first, you know, her and her sisters were the first people in their families to be born in the United States. Both my grandparents came through Ellis Island. So, and there's so many of us that have those stories, right? So I think that's it. You know, we worry about changing our society to one that's not inclusive anymore or less inclusive. I don't know that we've ever been inclusive. You know, we saw people today, Maria, and this bothers me. And I had an argument with one of my own kids about this, that America was never great. You know, there's signs down there, people with signs saying America's never been great. I disagree with that. I think that with all its bumps and bruises, America's never been perfect. But it certainly has been great. There are opportunities available to all of us in this country that wouldn't have otherwise be available to us if we lived in many other places in the world. And not that it's perfect. You know, and you look like somebody like me. I was orphaned at the age of 15, but there were people around to help me and help me get into school and get an education. I was able to change my life. And, you know, I'm not sure you can do that everywhere in the world. So I guess, you know, I still want to, I'm not ready to disregard America. I still think it's the greatest country on the planet. That doesn't mean we don't have things to fix. We certainly do.
That's exactly right. That's, and you're right. There is a distinction between perfect and great.
And you know what? I got to tell you, one thing that bothers me most about what's going on today in Lafayette Square is that today in the Washington Post, they wrote an article about this guy, Jason Kessler, who's leading all this stuff. And he's a graduate of the University of Virginia. He has a degree in psychology, Maria, from the University of Virginia. His stepmother was an African-American. He lived with an African-American Muslim at one point when he was in college. That was his roommate. You know, this I find so disturbing that people like this have gone over to this kind of racist rhetoric. I don't know. I mean, maybe that's condescending. Maybe that's a perfect liberal condescending attitude, is that we expect racists not to be well educated, not to be smart, not to be socially integrated. And it disturbs us to find out when they are. But certainly, this is not just, this is not a couple of good old boys with a fourth grade education and a picture. These are
really, Michael, it speaks to fear. Any kind of extremism is fear-based behavior. And for whatever reason, he's acting out in this manner. Other people could act out in more socially productive ways. It's a shame. I always think that. I had an experience this week. You probably aren't into this, but Mars and Mercury are both in retrograde until the 19th, and it affects communication and therefore technology. The first day that Mars and Mercury were in retrograde, my six-month-old laptop crashed irrevocably, and I was on the phone with Microsoft for 90 minutes to get it back up. And then on Friday, I got taken over by hackers, and I was completely disabled from getting into anything. And it said, call this 877 number, and Microsoft will walk you through it. Well, it turned out it was a phishing scam. And when I gave my credit card number to pay for the protection that I should have had at the time of purchase, it didn't show that Microsoft was the vendor. It flashed this agency out of New Jersey. And so, of course, I quick shut down everything because they had been in my computer with their cursor working it. So who knows what they've captured.
Right.
But I called American Express right away, and they said no charge came through because this vendor said it had been declined. So then they wanted me to transfer funds electronically, which then, of course, there's no recourse.
Right.
But my whole point in this is that somebody is seizing on innocent people to take advantage of them. Why aren't they solving world peace or cancer with their talent?
It's those Russians, Maria. They've targeted shadow politics. They want us. I don't know. You know, Mrs. Brown and I had our identity stolen. So that, you know, I feel your pain. We had our tax return stolen.
This man that you're talking about, who is educated and knows better, imagine what he could do with his tools instead of what he is doing with his skill set.
Well, and you're right. It's fear. And you know, I think the thing that bothers me about this guy is it's also ignorance. You know, I had the benefit of growing up in a family where my father was the most egalitarian person I've ever met in my entire life. And my mother's family, they were classic, you know, bigots, I would call them. They believed every stereotype about everybody. But, you know, I would say about my grandmother, she never looked to find out the truth. You know what I mean? She didn't like black people. She was afraid of black people. And she didn't associate with black people, so she didn't know any different. you know, other than the stereotypes. So that's what bothers me, I think, about this guy Kessler, is that he has had all that experience, but yet he's still on this path. But you're right, it's all about fear. You know, you understand that very early on when you're dealing with this stuff, that there's always fear involved. Well, speaking of fear, I'm afraid we've run out of time. And we'll see you next week, folks. And, you know, I hope you have a good week. And I hope you embrace somebody that's different this week and tell them that you're glad they're Americans, too.
Yes. Thank you for that in our all-inclusive conversation, as always.
Yes. And tonight we're going to leave you with a classic song from called A Change Is Gonna Come. Please, this was one of my favorites, and it was a stalwart of the civil rights movement, and it goes out to all those people that had the courage to go out today and stand up for what they believe in.
Nice.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.